Hello. Hello. How are you, my girl? Hello. Hello. Don't tell me to shush.
You know that's recording, right?
I do know it's recording. Joshy, you can't stop me from singing. Don't do that.
Welcome to the 50th episode.
Yay!
Of The Writer and the Critic.
Yay!
A monthly podcast.
Yeah, okay, keep going, yeah.
Devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy at the moment. Hi, Ian. Happy
Hello.
50th.
And what were you saying in the car when we were coming here?
Happy 50th?
No, yes, you said that. And then you said, did I ever think...
Oh, no, yeah.
Did, we would reach 50.
Yes, because I did
you
not.
Said, yeah, you said you did not.
I did not, because, like, that's, if, like, doing an episode a month, and we've actually, like, it's been longer, is 5 years. And I thought, we're not going to do 5 years
so
worth of this.
Which point did you think, which episode do you think would kill us?
No, like, there wasn't a particular, like, just when we very first started, I thought, well, we're not even going to get to 50, so, you know.
Yeah, okay. All right, well.
I can do this. It's only going to be a couple of years, and then we'll get bored.
Why did you assume I was the one who was going to get bored?
I don't know.
I've got a lot of staying power.
Well, I do too.
Despite in terms everything. Of podcasts, I should point out.
Alrighty.
Okay.
We're going to move right along.
Because this is going to potentially be a very long podcast.
Hopefully not. Before we get into the 50 books that you and I
I literally have no idea what books you've chosen.
No, we've just chosen 25 each.
Yes.
To hopefully make 50, unless there are overlaps, and then we have some emergency titles which may get brought off the bench.
Yes, correct.
But before we get into all that, we received some excellent feedback from Charles on the last episode, and we just wanted to...
Charles Tan,
yeah. And we just wanted to talk about that a little before we started, because he makes some really good points. And so we thought we would have a little discussion to, I guess, add on to what we were talking about last month. So
yes.
Basically Charles was sent us an email at the very beginning, which said our entire discussion that we had is a good example of systemic bias in publishing. And he's absolutely right, because, as he says, you know, the authors we were talking about and the type of fiction we were talking about isn't new. It's just the West in recent years has kind of started to notice it. And the reason that we weren't previously aware of stuff, and Ewing was saying that, in particular with the African anthology that we did, how can this be the start? There must be more. And there is, obviously. But because we, as English speaking people in Western publishing, which is strange being in Australia, but we, because of our history, we are definitely part of Western publishing.
Well, and the Commonwealth.
That's what I mean, right?
Yes.
Because of, even though we're really far away from Europe and the America, North America, we're still there. What was I saying? I can't remember.
We disregard, but aren't aware of this wider
That's
world.
That's right.
We have a very narrow
particularly
focus.
Sad, I think, considering how close Australia is to Asia.
Yes,
that
correct.
We don't, and how much of our populace has come from Asian countries
Correct.
Over the last century
it's
or two.
It's disgraceful, actually, in many ways.
So it is very, very sad. And I think it is an indictment on the publishing industry in Australia. Possibly more the genre publishing industry, I have to say. I think there is more diversity in literary fiction at the moment.
Generally,
it's not,
yes.
It's not recent.
No, there is.
I'm sorry, it's not, it hasn't been that way for a century, but there is. I think literary fiction is more interested in diverse voices in Australia at the moment.
No, I couldn't agree with you more.
Hopefully genre will catch up.
But get to his...
But anyway, so Charles says, take, for example, the reason you covered both Afro-SF and The Sea Is Ours in the same month. One of you picked an anthology that featured people of colour, POC, so the other one thought, hey, I'll pick another anthology that also features POC. Or at least to me as a listener, this was the impression in episode 48. Charles, you are so true.
That is actually exactly
that is
what happened.
Exactly what happened. And, yeah, we didn't even really pass that. So anyway, He continues on, this is both a boon and a curse, as these types of stories will always be framed around the ghetto of POC. At no point did you think these are just regular anthologies, but rather are perceived as POC anthologies, which to a certain extent helps in the marketing, but is also limited by that fact. And that's absolutely true. And he's spot on in that that's how we chose the books. I came across the steampunk anthology and I was really interested in it. And I said to you, hey, let's do this one. Let's find a book we can pair with it. And you said, oh, we could do this Afro SF one. It's like, perfect. Yes. That's exactly what happened without any further thought, despite the fact, as I told Charles in an email that we replied to him on, that we'd actually had a conversation just at the beginning of this year about how we wanted to look at more diverse voices in fiction.
Yes.
But that we didn't want to have, you know, special episodes around, hey, here's two black American writers who are women and we're going to talk about them together.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And yet that's exactly what we did, because we didn't think any further. It was just the first thing that popped into our head.
Although how much I take the blame.
It's us, because I didn't also go, we should do that one.
But he makes the point about that, you know, you didn't treat these like ordinary anthologies. You treated them as special snowflake
exactly.
anthologies.
Ghettoized books.
And
let's pull two books
from
the ghetto and
talk about
them. How
much of that is the fault of the anthology itself as the way it's marketed or pushed?
Well, I mean, certainly I think, as we mentioned on the last episode, both of those anthologies were, to some extent, targeted to Western audiences.
Yes.
And yeah, rightly so. They are staking a place in literature which is dominated by the West. I don't know that the fault of those anthologies is the right way to put it.
I'm being a smart ass because let's think about it. If an editor got together a whole bunch of people of color and from Asia, West Africa, Africa, wherever, America, wherever, put them all into an anthology, didn't write an introduction that was about, hey, look at all these new diverse voices, just said, here's an anthology about genre.
I think we still would have done the same thing.
Yeah, we would have still done the same thing.
Yeah,
we would have said, oh, wow, there's this new anthology out that collects all these horror, science fiction, fantasy stories by people of colour.
Let's find another one.
Yes, let's find another one.
Because correct. That's what we did. And I think, you know, because, you know, when I said to you, here's a book about steampunk from a different slant, and that's what was interested me. We didn't go, okay, well, maybe we can team that with another steampunk anthology.
Book. Correct.
Or, you know, like...
No, you're right. That's spot on.
Yeah, so that's absolutely true, and we acknowledge that is most definitely a good example of systemic bias, and we are absolutely a part of that because, you know, you and me, and we are part of the dominant voice.
Correct.
Not, you know, personally, but in terms of demographics where we fit in.
And considering the next 8 months we're just going to talk about white people, I think that point's been made really well.
That's so not true. You've seen our spreadsheet.
Yes, I know.
So I really did appreciate Charles pointing that out and giving us the opportunity to, kind of reflect on that and realise, oh, we fucked up. I'm still really glad we discussed both books, but yes, they possibly could have been discussed with different books throughout the year rather than... Yeah, doing a ghetto podcast in Charles's words.
Oh, my God, that's what we did. A ghetto podcast. I like that.
It's what we did.
Well, I don't like it, but, anyway, keep going.
So we will try to be more mindful of this in the future, and we already are being more mindful, but it just shows that when you don't actually really stop to consider all the angles and you do just take the first thing that pops into your head, this is what happens. This is an example of bias, like it's absolute bias. So that was us. but the other thing that Charles picked up in his email, which we kind of talked about, and we talked about especially, Ian, when you were saying, oh, these people need to write novels because they'll get noticed.
That's not the point I was making.
No, but you said that, right?
But yeah, it was more the point I haven't noticed them because they haven't written novels.
Exactly. But
which
also,
can be read the other way, which is they now must write novels so Ian notices them.
But also so other people like you and like people in the West, including reviewers and podcasts like this one, who focus on novels as the dominant form.
Yes, and also that it's sort of that you graduate to novels. That's when you really take it seriously.
And that's the idea that we have in the West. Yes. That you start mucking about with short fiction, and when you're good enough or noticed enough, you write a novel, and that's when you become a real writer. And I'm just going to quote again from Charles's email because he puts it really well, like the problem with this, again, bias towards a particular form. And he says, the second problem is the expectation that people's stories should be novels. First, the thick books we now label as novels is a specific format catering to Western tastes and economy. Remember when paperback novels could fit in your pocket. But for non-Western readers and writers, some of their traditions aren't in the novel format, hence the prevalence of short stories. This can also be an economic problem where local publishers do not have the funds or see a market in publishing long novels. And also remember that long novels take a lot of time to write, and in non-Western countries, finding the time to write is a privilege. So this shapes the types of stories that end up getting written, which in turn causes them to plummet into further obscurity, as a lot of Western tastes do not see, in brackets, financial value in short stories as opposed to novels. And Mondi's request that has the implicit hierarchy that novels are better than short stories, which isn't necessarily the case, but it is true that from a Western perspective, there is a larger financial market for the former than the latter. Again, really good points, and I kind of had a little pushback against you on the other episode talking about how I really do despise that novel is the dominant form.
I know you do.
But what I hadn't considered was Charles' point that again, it's not just that this form is dominant, but the people who get to participate in that form are people who have time to write a 200,000 word novel. Yeah, and it does take a lot of time. It takes a lot of time. You know, if you're not in the position, even if you are in the position to be writing full time, it still takes a lot of time, right? But yeah. If you're not in that position, how long is it going to take you to carve out those hours here and there to write a novel as opposed to some short stories? Because I having done both novels and short stories, 100,000 words of a novel takes a lot more energy and a lot more intellectual and emotional energy and time than it does to write 100,000 words worth of separate short stories, because you're sustaining this work over a long period of time, keeping it in your head and your brain and your writer stuff for ages. Whereas, a short story, you can, if you have a couple of weeks holiday, you can write this short story and it's done. You know, it's not like, well, a couple of weeks I'll write a bit of a novel and then, 6 months later, maybe I have another week to work on a novel. Or I carve out an hour at a time every morning because I get up early. I mean, it's hard. And I'm not saying that everyone in the West has the luxury of time to write novels. That's not true. But as Charles points out, it's a bigger issue for non-Western countries. People don't, it's again, as he says quite perfectly, it privileges the people who have the time and the finances and certainly the emotional, intellectual energy to write a long, sustained work.
Yeah.
And that's something I hadn't really considered. And I should have, because I've made that argument and seen that written down and read articles about it from a gender perspective, that women often don't have the time to write a novel.
Yeah. I don't want people to be led into thinking that the novel is the be-all and end-all, and that was what I was arguing. Within the structure that exists now, that's how it's perceived.
Absolutely.
And it was more a attack on publishers, Western publishers, actually genre Western publishers, because I did a comparison between literature and genre, and you can define literature however you want, but in terms of awards anyway, literature does a better job of it.
Let's say literary fiction.
Literary fiction, yes, sorry. Yes, correct. Literary fiction does a better job of it than genre fiction does in terms of promoting people of colour, etc., and diverse voices around the world.
And some of that might be, cookie hunting, but that's okay.
It could be, but, there's a really good example. Man Booker have an international prize for translated works.
And that's really recent, like 2-3
Well, The Voice had it. The Voice had the prize, but what has happened now is previously it was for a body of work by an author. It's actually
individual books. It's now going to be individual, like
the Man Booker. Yeah. Now, us genre guys had a translated prize as well, but because of a lack of funding and, we could get Cheryl Morgan on to discuss it in great detail, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. But Man Booker has dollars all around it. It has money. And you can do that sort of thing where genre just doesn't have the economy of scale, whatever.
But, it wouldn't be too hard, for example, for the Hugo Awards to introduce a translated works category.
Yes, although that probably just made a whole lot of people go quite hungry and red in the face.
It wouldn't be that hard.
And they're now saying to you, well, go to a business meeting then, Kirsten.
I can't, because I'm in Australia. We very, very, very rarely get world cons here.
But I think your point is valid. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It would be, okay, there's, it's not like, we just create a category. But, you know, in terms of logistics, like, it's not that hard. You could create another category which focused on. Now, you know, again, you'd have the problem like with the Oscars. We have the international film and that's shoved down the bottom of the couch and no one really talks about it. And that would, you know,
but that,
we
that's
still have
why
the issue,
what
but
Man
at least
Booker
it's there.
Did. That's why
there.
That's why what Man Booker did was so important because they've actually said, no, this is a separate prize. Yep. It's being and it's going through the exact same process as the normal Man Booker does, and normal in scare quotes.
Well, the original one.
The original, the Western, I don't know, however you want to call
the
it.
The original Man Booker.
In that it's long list, then another month short list, then another month winners announced.
Yep.
And that's – so it's not just rush, yeah, here's a bunch of translated books.
Yeah.
It's here it is. And it's. I think that is wonderful.
I think it is
And
too.
I wish we could have the economies of scale and genre to do something similar. And I know there was an attempt, but it didn't get off – you know,
no,
didn't
because,
consistently
again,
get off the ground.
You know, it's, again, volunteer stuff is really hard.
No, absolutely.
It is sad, but but, yeah, I mean, that could maybe be a first step. So all those people who can get to world cons and business meetings, maybe agitate for a translated works category. It would be kind of cool.
Would you have that over a young adult category?
Oh, no.
Anyway.
Okay, no, we're not getting to a Hugo Awards discussion.
Oh, why not?
Oh, I wish I hadn't brought it up.
No, no, but the point is to not – I've completely derailed the conversation. Charles's letter was fantastic, absolutely picks up on – both the systemic bias, you know, that is inherent.
In the
system that we grew up in, and in fact will be reflected in the 25 books that I choose.
It's amazing how
this letter by Charles
dovetails
perfectly into this 50th episode and the 25 books that we're each going to show you. Because I think you'll see, at least from mine, and I don't know about yours, but at least from mine.
From mine too.
It's not just men, it's white men. Mine is full of white dicks.
My list is, yes.
There's a bit more, is there? Okay.
No, and I just wanted to, because I sent Charles an email back, and I made a pledge to Charles in that email. I just wanted to say it publicly as well that, you know, reading Charles's email, writing my reply, it's like, again, like, I love short fiction. I love short fiction. I love writing it. I love reading it. It's my preferred form of the written word. And what we've been doing on the podcast is mostly focusing on novels. I mean, we do mostly do that.
Yes, we do. And I'm to blame because I personally love the novel.
When we were doing we each select a book, I was selecting novels more often than not, way more often than not, right? Yep. We do have very few short story collections and fewer anthologies that we've actually talked about.
That's true. Well, it's always a special episode for an anthology.
And that's what we usually do, isn't it? And which I think is fine because sometimes it is hard to talk about a novel versus a collection of shorter works, whether that's by a single author or multiple authors. But I did say to Charles that we're going to be looking at more collections and anthologies and possibly mosaics from now on. And that will also bring in a more diversity of non-Western writers too, because we'll be able to find shorter fiction to talk about.
Yes.
So that's a promise, absolutely. And I may have made a change to our spreadsheet, Ian, reflecting that already.
Oh, I haven't noticed.
No, because you never check.
No, I don't.
Anyway.
Before we end off, I would recommend two books written by African writers that I've read recently, one which, if it's any good, the review will be up on a site elsewhere, which is Making Wolf by Tade Thompson, who was in AfroSF. Very good. And Black Ass.
Black Ass.
It's called Black Ass by A. Igoni Barrett. I like Making Wolf more, I'll be honest, but both I recommend.
Cool. But they are novels.
They are novels.
Anyway, so thank you, Charles, for your very excellent feedback and for kicking our butts, which we did need. Everyone needs their butt kicked from time to time, especially from someone as smart as Charles. Yes, so thank you for that. And we are keeping everything in mind and we will try to be more mindful, especially now that we're doing more curatorial stuff. And
yes,
not just,
absolutely.
Yay, a book
I'd like
we
to
liked.
Thank Charles as well.
Yep. Okay.
So,
50 books.
Yes.
So how we're going to do this is I think we'll just alternate.
Yes.
But before we begin on our actual lists of 25 books each, hopefully making 50, I just want to talk for a couple of minutes about how we chose our particular list, because these are not like best of anything lists.
Correct.
So Ian, what kind of principles governed your list?
My entire principle was what the formative books of my childhood, teenage years, uni years, and a couple, and I tried to limit these, but a couple of others that have come after.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so that's how I've looked at it. And they will be ordered as such. So I'm going to start with, you know, essentially one of the first things I read and go cool. like that. But each of these are things that I had to remember off the top of my head. I didn't want to go searching my memory for hours on end to come up with these titles. Everything I'm going to talk about today are things that still have stuck with me.
Cool. Absolutely.
The quality is variable.
But for some reason.
They have stuck.
Yeah.
And they've inspired me in some way. So they're part of my formative years. And as I said, about, I think I counted, 85 to 90% are written by men who are white.
Which is not surprising.
It is indicative of my upbringing.
And I think.
And what was available to me. And the fact that, I don't know if you've got, but like Judy Blume.
Oh, I forgot Judy Blume.
On your list? No, okay. Well, no. See, someone like
well,
Judy.
I didn't forget, actually. I'll get to okay. my list.
But a writer like Judy Blume, as an example, who was around and I was aware of, that was Cooties.
Not that anyone told me
that I shouldn't read Judy Blume because I'm a boy and that's girl Cooties, but more that it just, that was the environment. You just didn't read, boys didn't read Judy Blume.
Fair enough.
So that's why you won't find Judy Blume on my list. Anyway. What's your motivation?
Well, if you didn't read her, that would be a very good reason.
Correct.
Okay.
Oh, and that was the thing. I didn't want to pander. I didn't want to just chuck.
No, this is not about pandering. And I think if I'd done the exact same thing you did, my list would also be predominantly white men because I think that's what I was mostly reading in my not in my childhood thing. I read lots of books by women, actually. But what I did was, because of this podcast, I actually kind of limited it mostly to speculative-type books.
Okay.
There's a few ones that are borderline that I just love and snuck in there.
Most of mine are speculative.
But it's mostly speculative. So I didn't put in books like Judy Blume because I didn't even think of her because I was decided just because it's such an impossible task to winnow down to 25.
But the Sweet Valley High books, I think, isn't
oh,
that
I never read them. No,
oh,
I didn't.
You? But
them.
Again, they were considered to be verboten for boys. Boys didn't read them.
They were verboten.
Nancy
for a
Drew.
Lot of girls.
I didn't read.
Oh,
Nancy
I love
Drew.
Nancy Drew. Yeah, but I didn't put any of that in.
Okay, gotcha.
Because I decided to make it mostly my 50 favourite kind of speculative nature
okay.
books. Because, oh my God, if I opened it to every... Oh, I don't even want to think about it. Couldn't do 25.
I'm not requesting. People can say whatever they want. But I am fully aware that this is a case for me. A white guy comes up with a list of white guy books. I understand
but
that.
But I think that's good. It's illustrative.
Yes.
Illustrated the
that's what it was
systemic
for me.
Bias.
Correct. All right, I'm starting.
And so the other thing that I did was because it got so impossible and I was so stressed because I really was because you like books look at you and you go, oh, but I liked you too. And we had a thing about only one author. So some yes. of my books are emblematic choices.
Same
I think,
here.
To I've reflect got, an author.
Yes, I've got the same. Yep.
And it doesn't mean that. Necessarily even that, because, you know, gee, some of them were really hard. Anyway, so mostly speculative. And, yeah, they had to be books that – and mine aren't all. In fact, very few of mine are, like, they span a time period. I've got some from when we were doing the podcast, actually. Because, yeah, there are books – I found some interesting patterns in my reading behavior, actually, as a reader, which we'll get to. So let's start. So that's kind of our framing.
Do we have to do a coin toss to who goes first?
You go first. There we go.
All right, there you
so
go.
So what's your first book? Because also the other thing I'll say is I've done mine roughly in chronological order, not necessarily of when the book was published, but when I kind of remember, like, did I read this one before that one?
Well, as I said,
roughly chronological.
Mine is in order of period.
Yeah, okay. Right? So, mine is in no way like my number one book is the number one book. They're just in a rough chronological order.
Yes, okay. Now, I don't actually remember when I read things because that would be insanity.
No, it's rough.
But it is rough, yeah. Okay, so my first is Mr. Impossible by Roger Hargreaves, published in 1976.
Oh, my God.
Now, that is emblematic because I read all the Mr. Men books. I didn't read the Little Miss books.
Oh, the Mr. Men. The Mr. Men books.
Yeah, what did you think I was talking about?
No, I off the radar.
Really?
I read them all.
All right. Yeah. So, good. That means our lists are going to be different. Okay. Roger, this was – my mum bought these for
Mr.
me.
Mr. Impossible.
My mum bought – I picked Mr. Impossible because I suppose it is the most speculative of the bunch. And actually, it's the one I like the most. And I've reread them recently with Joshy. So that's how come they've stuck in my head. But they would have anyway because they were the first things that my mum collected for me when I was a little tyke. So they are
nice, seminal
in my life. The
yeah, we had them all too. In fact, me and my two sisters read them so much, my mum ended up having to actually stitch them back together
because
they fell apart.
Yeah, well, now for my son though, we collected all the Little Miss books as well. Now, I didn't have that, but we did it for him, and I've read all those too, and they are great as well. So, yeah. I mean, they're a little bit, hey, let's have a Mr. Man, Little Miss version of a Mr. Man character, and the Mr. Men do pop up a lot in the Little Miss books, as if the Little Miss can't hold the story
can't
on her own. But...
And, of course, the Mr. Men... kind of have, because there was like, it was 100 and something. There was so many of
them. It's about 70 of the whole lot. The whole,
and they kind of took all the good things.
Yeah.
You know, so Little Miss comes along and she's got a Little Miss Mischief.
Yeah, that, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Like Mr. Man got all the kind of the really strong basic characteristics that they get to be. So that's a bit sad, but it is good that they did make the Little Miss.
Correct. So there you go.
Excellent.
That's my first.
My first book is a book that I must have read 3 or 4 dozen times when I was a kid. I loved it so much. It's called No Flying in the House by Betty Brock.
I've never heard of that.
And it's just like I got it. It was one of the books we got from Ashton Scholastic Book Club. That's where a lot of my books when I was a kid came from that.
Yes, I know that. That I do.
I'm not sure I even knew bookstores existed until I was maybe like 8 or 9.
So you'd get them like once a month in school,
and you take them home and you fill out what you want, and anything that was a horse, which aren't on any of my lists, by the way, because speculative, I got. And I'd also get like other ones that have like fantasy type books. And No Flying in the House, I looked it up. It was actually published in 1970, but I would have read the 1978 reprint or something like that. And it's this great little book about a girl who called Annabelle, who has this little tiny white dog who can talk and do magic tricks. And she goes to stay with her grandmother, I think. And it's just this, I mean, spoilers, I guess. She ends up like she's her missing parents come back, and there's something magical about them. But there's this, the lady, the grandmother who she goes to stay with, I think it's her grandmother. Gosh, you'd think after 36 readings I'd remember, but I have not read it for 20 years. I still have the book. I still have that edition. I have. There's not many I've kept, but that one I kept. And the lady has all of these little gold wind up toy statue things that you wind them up and they do something. And the thing that always got me, always made me sob when I read this book, was at some point this thing happens and the dog, to save Annabelle, has to turn herself – oh, my God, I'm getting teary.
Oh, no.
Has to turn herself into one of these clockwork animals as a sacrifice to save Annabelle because this bad thing happens. And it's just – oh, it's so awful. And as a clockwork animal, she can she can still do the 98 tricks she could always do, except for one where she used to dive into a bowl of water because the clockwork would rust. And it's so sad. But it has a really lovely ending because the things get changed. And it's I love that book so much. It's like it's got this handprint in my heart forever.
Wow. Okay.
So that's my number one.
All right.
Well, my first book.
you might have this one. Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know.
The Magic Faraway Tree.
I don't think I've ever read The Magic Faraway Tree.
You're joking.
No, I don't think I ever have.
Now, there's a book I read multiple times. In fact, Ina Blyton generally.
Yeah, I read a bit of Ina Blyton, but not much.
The Wishing Chair Thingamabob. But The Magic Faraway Tree, I distinctly remember. And again, wasn't a book that it was a book that that my parents got. In fact, we got most of the Ina Blytons. And published, by the way, in 1943. Did you know that?
Oh, wow.
Yes. And I just remember sitting next to the bookshelf reading that book a number of times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go through the plot,
the
Magic Faraway
Tree. No, I don't think I've ever read it because we didn't really have Ina Blyton as a kid. And I read a little bit of Ina Blyton. And when you're a bit older, she's a bit twee. So I never kind of went back and read.
Yeah, I read it at the perfect age. So, which
we had all of them. We had all of the naughty books. I used to read them to my sisters. I think that was enough Ina Blyton for me. And we had the Gollywog editions. Just quiet.
Kirsten. All right. Anyway, that's my second.
Okay, my second one is the only other one I have from like way back, and it's an emblematic book to some extent, but it was also my favorite of hers. There was an author called Ruth Chu. And again, we got her through the Ashton Scholastic Book Club, and she'd write these books and like. They were pretty, like all of the ones I read, there were only 4 or 5 I read. They were all about two siblings, a sister and a brother, and the sister was always a couple of years older than the brother. And that there'd be some, like they were set in the real world, in America, so somewhere like, I can't remember where they were set, but somewhere like Boston or Pittsburgh, right? And there'd be some little magic thing and they weren't the same brother and sister, they were different in every book, but it was always an older sister and a younger brother. And they were like the brother might have been about 8 or 9 and the sister might have been 11 or 12, that sort of age. And they'd find some little magic thing and stuff would happen. And my favourite was secondhand magic, which was about they found some string and some glue and they had this old broken kite and they fixed the kite with this magic glue and it became alive.
Yep.
And they could, and it flew them places and other things happened. But, and I just love those books. And thinking about it, it's like, oh, that's the kind of stuff I write where it's set, like mine's a lot darker, but stuff that's set here and now, but with a little thing that
is, so you think that inspired
different.
You as a writer?
I think it must have gotten into the nuts and bolts okay. as, because I just love them so much.
So where
I
is loved, she now as a writer?
I didn't, this, Secondhand Magic was published in 1981, and they were all published around about that time. To be honest, I didn't actually go and look up to see if she's written stuff recently. I don't know. I should have, but, it's also that kind of thing. It's like, oh yeah, she's a real person and she might have written other stuff. She's not just an artifact from my childhood. But what I loved about those books was you always, because they were set like here and now, you could imagine that you might find a little old junk shop one day and buy a tube of glue and it might be magic and you might do, you know, they were just delicious. And I, again, those were ones I read over and over and over. But Secondhand Magic, I think, was my favourite one.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, my third. Now, you're going to get this, the pattern here is pretty clear. I had a very traditional childhood.
Yep.
Pretty vanilla, because my third book is The Twits.
The Twits. I've not read that.
By Roald Dahl.
Yeah, I've read a lot of Roald Dahl, but not that one.
Published in 1980. This one was one we were read to at school, I'm pretty damn sure. So the thing about The Twits, well, The Twits is about two disgusting human beings, yep. essentially, who do horrible things and get their comeuppance, and who I've bought a copy for my son who has just read it. So he could tell us actually more about it than I could right now because I haven't read it in absolutely donkey's years. And in fact, I don't even know if I actually read it. I'm pretty sure it was read out to us
okay.
in class.
Yeah. Well, that counts. Yeah, so, like an audio book, but live.
And I haven't also read out to us in class for all the Narnia, well, some of the Narnia books, but I haven't put them in this list because they didn't have such an impact on me. But this did mostly because one scene early on in the book where Mr. Twit has food in his beard.
Oh.
And he eats bits of the food in his beard and it collects in there. And that just stuck with me. It has always stuck with me, this concept. Whenever I see a beard, I'm not joking. When I see something, especially hipsters these days, and I see a hipster beard, I think, is there food in
is
it?
There food
and are they, they're like Mr. Twit. They just, you know, they
so
store their
food.
This
is why you will never grow a full beard.
No. They will store the food in the beard
for
and
later.
Eat for later. That is what it is all about. And thank you, Roald Dahl, for that, because that's changed my life.
That's awesome.
And damn you, hipsters. There you go. It's a cautionary tale about hipsterism. Anyway, keep going.
Okay. So, well, my third book, we're skipping forward now into teenage years. And again, it's an emblematic book. So one of my favourite authors that I read in my teens and early 20s, I think, was Ramsay Campbell.
Oh, okay.
And
very
I,
good.
I've got to say.
Wow. You're jumping. This is your teenage years. You're reading Ramsay Campbell.
Yeah. I read Jaws when I was 8. Didn't understand everything.
Okay.
But anyway.
Which one? Which Ramsay? Because I've read a few.
So the one I chose is a short story collection called Scared Stiff.
Oh, okay.
And I chose that one because, I've always preferred his – in fact, I've very few of his novels that I've read I've enjoyed.
Well, The Count of 13 or whatever.
Count of 11 is the only 11. One. When I went and looked at my bookshelf, I was like, that's the only novel of his I've kept.
Okay.
It made the call.
What I think was A Count of 13. Anyway, you keep going. Yeah.
But I've always loved his short fiction, and he writes really disturbing, creepy, off-kilter, not always supernatural, but often. And they just kind of get under your skin. And but the Scared Stiff collection, which is a very thin collection, it's only got about 6 or 7 stories in it. A couple of stories from them have just always kind of stuck with me. Like I've just remembered lines or scenes from them. And it's sort of erotic horror, which I guess when I was reading it, might have been one of my first intros to erotic horror.
Wait,
so it was a little bit
it's
naughty.
Called Scared Stiff, yeah?
Yeah, it's called Stiff. It's not the best title.
Is that a ref- is that
it's a double entendre?
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
But it's a really, really good.
Did you get that it was a double entendre when you were 14 or whatever?
I think so. I think I got that.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's kind of like sticks in my memory. Some of those stories, and I really, really, really like Ramsay Campbell's short fiction. But I haven't read a lot recently, which is a trend in my list. Okay. We'll get to that.
Good. All right. Well, yes, mine fourth book, because we're at number four.
Four.
Is The Nightmare of Eden by Terence Dix, a Doctor Who novelisation.
Oh,
which
wow.
was published in 1980, but is a novelisation of an episode from, oh, my God, 1979, I think. Anyway, it doesn't the actual story, Nightmare of Eden, is – actually, I like it a lot. It's during the Graham Williams era of Doctor Who. I'm not going to spend 20 minutes talking about this.
Please don't.
It features the mandrels. It actually has this really cool conceit that the monster turns out to be a narcotic drug. When you zap the monster with electricity or something, they disintegrate and the residue is a narcotic drug, which is quite adult and cool, and yet the mandrels themselves are the least scariest thing in the world. They're meant to be scary, but they're not. Anywho, it's a Tom Baker Lala Ward thing, but the point is, the reason why I've chosen this is because it was the first Doctor Who novelisation that was bought for me by my mum. My mum does feature a bit in this early part. She was that, nice. And I'll never forget that. It's not necessarily the best one. But Terence Dix wrote about 130,000 of them. You were about 80. But, yeah, it was the first one that was purchased for me, and I won't forget it. And in the garage, which I'm pointing to, which no one can see, in a box, it exists. And I actually – oh, no, it was Horns of an Ironmon I took one of my old ones to a convention to get annotated by Doctor Who fans.
Oh, wow.
That was Horns of Nymon. It wasn't Nightmare of Eden. But Nightmare of Eden was the first one I got.
Excellent.
And if anyone knows the cover, it's got Tom Baker in the front and he's got that very Tom Bakery look, but it's got a mandrel behind him. And they look shit on the cover too.
And it doesn't look like a monkey mandrel. It's not a mandrel as in our monkey.
No, it's essentially a furry thing.
Right.
With claws, except they're BBC budget claws, so they don't look like claws. Okay. But it's just a big lump of fur, really. Anyway.
Okay, so my number four is it's made the list because it's a book I think about all the time, but I've not read since I first read it, and it's We've Ruled by Clive Barker.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the first author we've come across that I also have of, but not We've Ruled.
Oh, good. Yeah. And I remember, and I read a lot of Clive Barker in my teens and early 20s. And We've Ruled of his big, elaborate fantasy novels, horror fantasy novels, is the one that kind of resonated and stuck with me and always has, and I think about it a lot. I don't know how accurately because it's been a long time. Just as a side note, we had a pet pigeon when yes. I was a kid, a teenager, that just turned up out of the blue. It was just a rat grey pigeon. It wasn't anything special, but he just turned up and wouldn't leave. And because there was a pigeon in the opening of We've World, I called my pigeon Clive.
I've never looked, see that. I don't know that story. I've known you
there
how
you
long.
Go. Where, Clive, my pigeon.
What a special episode this is going to be. Okay, so is it me now?
Yes, so that's my number four.
That's a good one.
Clive Barker.
And Clive Barker will appear again with me. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you can't guess which Clive Barker. Anyway, so my next one is War of the Worlds.
Okay.
By Herbert George Wellie. Mm-hmm. 1898, Wellie, I said Wells. That was
Wells,
yes.
Yep,
1898 yep. published. Towards probably my later junior school years, I came across a copy. It was always, I'm pretty sure I found it in my grandparents' house, which is odd. I don't know why, but I'm pretty sure it was there. I think my mum had a copy for years that she'd kept in the house. Anyway, I read it and I loved it and, yes. What more can you say about it? I mean,
War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds. I mean, again, I'm not going to belabor the point here and spend 10 minutes talking about a book that
is
pretty traditional and most people have heard of.
No, my first exposure to War of the Worlds was actually the soundtrack, the Vangelis?
It's not Vangelis.
It's not Vangelis.
But I know what you mean.
But yeah, and that was because my parents had it in a LP, like big black circle for the kids, gatefold edition, and mum would play it occasionally, and I really love that. You know, and I honestly don't know if I've actually read the book now. I cannot remember.
Really?
I think I have. I know I've read The Time Machine and I've read The Island of Dr. Moreau. I don't know if I've read The Time Machine.
Well, as people are going to find out later in the year, I haven't read Dracula.
Or if it just exists in my head from that audio, which was really good.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what to tell you. Other than the fact that it's a seminal book in my life and I haven't read Dracula.
Okay.
So that's my fifth
book. My fifth book is a bit of a cheat.
Why has it a cheat? You haven't read it? It doesn't really exist? It's one of yours?
No.
It's Jason?
It's technically...
Not a book?
More than one book.
Oh, it's a trilogy.
It's the Dark Tower series.
Oh, you can't...
But if you press me, then I will select the last book in that series, which is also called The Dark Tower.
Okay, so this is your Stephen King choice.
This is my Stephen King choice.
I was convinced you would choose the same thing I was going to choose, which because I've got a Stephen King as well. But you didn't.
It was really hard because it had to be a Stephen King because for most of my life I've read Stephen King. I've started reading Stephen King when I was 8 or 9 and I've read almost everything he's written and I've come to the very, very like genuinely tragic realization that I may have grown beyond Stephen King because his last 3 or 4 books that I've read, I just haven't enjoyed.
I haven't read Revival.
I haven't enjoyed. I abandoned Revival. I have never not finished, even Rose Madder. I finished Rose Madder.
Yeah, okay.
I've never not finished a Stephen King book and I just was kind of bored. Like, it's really sad because this is literally a writer who I barely remember a time when I've not had the memory of a Stephen King story or book. It's really sad. But The Dark Tower, I chose that because that whole series, but especially that last book, is just an amazing work. The time scale that the series spans.
Both literally and...
Well, literally.
Because how long it took him to write it.
And I never read them. I never read them until the last one was published.
Oh, really?
I bought them. I hoarded them. And I read them all in like a 6-month period, which was amazing. It's kind of why I class it as one book because for me it was.
That's one mofo book.
Yeah. And all of the meta stuff that he brought in and the biographical stuff and how he made it work and I kind of look at it as the quintessential Stephen King project. It's like all of his concerns and obsessions are in there. The connections between books all come to fruition in the Dark Tower series. The meta stuff he was beginning to play with is at the heart of the book by the end of it, though couldn't have been when he started. And the fact that the things you know about his biography that quite literally have changed the Dark Tower because the biographical stuff that he's put in there about his accident that he had and everything,
that's right.
Could not possibly have been a plan from the start, but they're so integral and that kind of makes you think about the world and how writers move through the world and use what happens to make art. And I love that series so much. I can see myself reading it another couple of times before I die, providing I live long enough. because, it made such an impact. And it's, like I said, it's bittersweet because for me I feel like that might have been the last really amazing thing by Stephen King that really connected deeply with me. I mean, it's not the last thing I loved, but it's the last thing.
So you didn't read the thing that the HBO have now done, the 11/22/63?
I hated that book so much.
Okay.
I really hated that book so much. It's the only one that I've hated. A couple others I've gone, meh. But yeah, so it's bittersweet. But I love that series. I think it's incredible. It's an amazing achievement. If that is the last thing that Stephen King writes that I've deeply loved, I'm happy with that.
Yep, okay.
So that's my number 5, either book or series, depending how I'm allowed to have it.
So, no, that's right. I don't have any series, so I didn't.
But I did read it, like, back to back all at once. So
you broke the rules.
For me, in my head, it's a book, but there you go.
So my next author is a book that was published in 1983. Yep, 1983. And we're now into my secondary school period. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'd be surprised if you haven't heard Robert Westall.
I've heard of it. I don't think I've read any Robert Westall.
The book.
Oh, wait. No, did he write Zed for Zachariah?
No.
That was.
And I actually had Zed for Zachariah on my list, but I took it off. That was Robert O'Reilly or something. Okay. But it was something O'Reilly. Anyway, derailed.
Go.
The book I chose, now the one that most people will have heard of is The Machine Gunners.
Ah, right. Yep. Not read it, but I've heard of it. Yep.
Which I did read at school, but it's not the book I've chosen. I've chosen Future Track 5.
Okay, I've not heard of that one.
Which is, we all talk about Hunger Games and all the dystopian fiction that exists. Robert Westall, that's where it starts. this is 1984 inspired.
Zed for Zachariah is pretty dystopian.
Well, it's more, no.
But anyway,
yes, it is, but it's more apocalyptic than dystopian. Mm-hmm. This is where grim British future in England where everyone's broken up into castes and it's dark and violent and different people have different functions in this society and that sort of thing. And I loved it at the time, and I've not reread it since. But I remember it because it had this grimness to it, and which for my 13-year-old head was a bit too much. And also, kids died violently at least once. You know, one kid gets gets shot, and his blood spurts out, and you know, which did
make an impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sticks with you. You know, and it probably made me into a splatterpunk that I became in my early 20s. So I blame Robert Westall. But, yeah, Machine Gunners, though, just as a side, and the sequel, which is something Full Fathom 5 or something like that. Anyway, are great books.
Okay.
Yes, anyway, as well.
So my number six, I had to thought really long and hard about it because the author's Caitlin R. Kiernan. And
so why'd you have to think about it?
I love so many of her books.
Oh, okay.
And I went with Tales of Pain and Wonder because
that's a collection?
It's a collection.
Okay.
Published in 2002 and it's been reissued since but with some stories taken out and others added in. But it's probably the book that of her earlier work because as much as I've loved The Red Tree and The Drowning Girl, but they're the only two novels of hers that I have really loved.
Yep.
Her other novels have been had various problems, but I've always loved and continue to love her short fiction kind of above.
So you get all the Subterranean Press versions?
Oh, I do.
Yes, okay.
Yes. Oh, so much money's gone to Sub Press over the years. And Tales of Pain and Wonder it's a really strong anthology. I mean, she's made very strong anthologies since, but this I think was the first one that I read a collection. I still have images and stories and characters and bits of dialogue from that are in my head.
So what, you read it in 2002 or read the stories individually?
No, I read it. And there was a couple in there that I think I'd read in Best New Horrors and things previously, but I read this collection. And the version I have has beautiful illustrations by Richard Kirk, who does these amazing detailed sort of pointillism type things. And they're just, and that married with her stories. It was a perfect match of author and illustrator. Just that whole book. I remember I took it to a writing retreat that I went to and spent a lot of time reading this book instead of writing, which is very bad. But it's a wonderful book. A really, really, I guess, dug into me. And as I said, like images and characters, Salambo and Salma Gundi, that's where they're two sisters and she's written recurring stories about them.
Okay.
And I think that's the first time I read them. And yeah, I love this book so much.
I love how you're getting into all this adult horror stuff. And I'm the next book.
Oh, I'm 2002, so I was a grown up.
Yeah,
I've skipped a lot of the childhood stuff. I have. But I did start reading adult fiction very early.
I'm still stuck in 1985. You must have read this.
Okay.
Space Demons by Julian Rubinstein.
No. I don't think I read a lot of...
Do you even know the book?
I've heard of it. I don't think I read a lot of juvenile science fiction. I read a lot of fantasy and horror for kids and young adult.
All right.
I don't think we had young adult when I was young adult.
Well, this was a school book.
But, yeah,
this was a book from year 7. I remember it distinctly. Because suddenly school became cool because they were giving us Space Demons to read. I don't think anyone in the class read it, but I read it. I certainly did.
Didn't you all have to read it?
Well, you know, kids in school, they read half a book and they pretend, you know. I mean, year 7, year 8.
I just remembered a book I should have put in anyway.
Well, too late.
Too late.
1985 it was published. Basically, it's Tron.
Oh, God.
In book form, where, I'm not going to go through the character names, but a father brings home a video game from Japan because all the kooky stuff happens in Japan.
Absolutely.
And via the means of a special gun that comes with the game, you can actually enter the game.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And sort of like a video drone.
So a bunch of friends get lost in the game. Yeah, it's not existence.
Okay.
It's more like Tron, you know, a bunch of friends,
Tron.
But through the computer. And it's very 1980s. I mean, you know, it's, I mean, if you look at the cover, I'm going to show you the cover and you'll see.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Oh.
And look at the baddies. The baddies are essentially weird looking punk like characters
really
with mohawks. So It was awesome, mostly because it had laser guns.
Okay. You and your laser guns.
Yeah, because the special gun was a laser gun. And
listeners, if you're unaware, Ian loves laser guns.
Laser guns, laser beams, blasts.
Any lasery like things, he's there.
Yes, and that'll be reflected in another one of my choices.
Oh, dear.
So, Space Demons by Gillian Rubinstein. You should go read it.
Okay, I don't know that I will.
Oh, okay.
I should have put in playing.
I'm telling you, for some people here, they'll be going, "Yeah, Space Demons. This is so. This is Australia in the 1980s.
It's funny. I should have put in playing Beattie Bo by Ruth Park. We had to read that for school. That's a really good book. It's not on my list. It's an unofficial book. It's like, you know, 6.5.
Okay. Move along.
So, well, my number 7, was that your 7?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So my number 7 is a book we did talk about on the podcast.
Have we already done 7? Wow.
Have you done 7?
Yeah, we have. Yep. You're right.
And it's We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson.
That's on my list.
I love this book so much. If that's on your list, no. Then I'm going to substitute Playing Beattie Bo by Ruth Park. That's my 7. That's my new 7.
Okay, cool.
Which is awesome. And it's a book I had to read for school. And I think that's why it didn't kind of cross my radar, because I was thinking of books that I have and still have and that I've kept over the years. And yeah, we read that for school. And it's an Australian book. It's set in, it's set in Sydney, and it's a time travel book. This girl basically finds this, it's a bit of lace, I think, like a lace collar.
You know, I never read it.
And this transports her back to the rocks in, I can't remember the year, but the 1800s. And she has to find her way back. But in the meantime, she's with this family, and it's this amazing book. I really, really loved it. I didn't love a lot of books we had to read for high school, I'll admit that. But this one I really loved. And most of the kids in my class hated it so much, especially the boys, because it was all about girls.
See, I know the book. I've never read the book.
So that's my new number seven, because you've already got that one. So
yeah,
excellent.
Except I think you're probably going to say more interesting stuff about the Shirley Jackson than I will.
I'll say it when you say it. That's really good.
Okay.
Playing Beattie Bo by Ruth Park, which now I really want to track down and reread, because I remember loving that so much. I read it like more than once, because you didn't have to. I read it once for school also, but I read it again just for myself.
That is our first crossover.
There we go.
Okay. Now,
so you're number 8.
I'm number 8. You must have read this.
Okay.
The Chocolate War.
Oh, my God.
You must have read The Chocolate War.
I loved Robert Cormier.
You have?
Yes. Okay. I read The Chocolate War.
Now, there isn't a more outside of fiction book written.
Oh, my God.
Where you're reading that. You would have read it when you were 14 or 15 as well.
Yeah.
And it is entirely it's entirely outside of fiction. A nonconformist boy and the violence inherent in that and bullying and all that sort of stuff. And I haven't chosen it because it's, in a sense, a cliche, but because it's a fucking awesome book.
Yeah.
It is a great piece of writing.
It really is.
The film's also good too.
Did you read any other Robert Cormier?
That was the only one I read. I actually read the sequel. The Thing He Eats, What's Its Face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I loved him. I've got those books. I don't know why, because again, not really spec fic.
So basically, I'm triggering a whole bunch of memories for you.
My favorite of his was one called I am the cheese.
Yeah,
the cheese stands alone.
Yeah, the cheese stands alone.
Oh my God, that blew my mind.
Yeah, the cheese stands alone.
I don't think I really understood it properly when I read it. I think I need to reread it now. I'm a grown up. I love that book. And also he wrote one after the first death, I think it was called, about the terrorists who take over a bus and of school kids. And I haven't thought about that book for years.
Is it Cormier or Cormier? Anyway, it doesn't really matter. But the point is, he's in a sense forgotten.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't understand how that's possible.
Maybe
there's something zeitgeisty about him. He was of the 80s, in the 80s.
I had to read The Chocolate War for school, if I remember correctly, and I didn't read anything else by him because I liked The Chocolate War. I didn't love it. But then in uni, I did a young adult module or something, and we had to read The Cheese Stands Alone. And then I started to read all these other ones by him.
But why do you think he's vanished off the face of the earth?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not up with, because I don't have kids. what books are being, like classic books are being, still being published. Is he, has he disappeared off the face?
Maybe he hasn't. Maybe it's just,
yeah, so it's still publishing it. Judy Blume and Betsy Byatt.
That's a good question. Anyway, I loved it. So
yeah. Wow. Cool. Cool. Okay. So my number eight is, a book by Poppy Z. Bright.
Of course.
Who I have always loved. He writes, I'm going to say he because, he now identifies as a man. So I don't know what the protocol is of talking about Poppy Z. Bright when he was identifying as a woman. So I'm just going to say he. So he wrote, I kind of like chop his career in half because he wrote a whole bunch of really dark, beautiful, lyrical horror novels and short stories. And then he wrote these funnier, lighter...
New Orleans foodie books.
And about two chefs in New Orleans. And I love both sides of that career equally. They're both amazing, amazing, amazing books. I mean, amazing sets of books. Really, really love them both. But what I chose was Drawing Blood.
Yep, okay. That's a classic.
Yeah, it's not as a classic as Lost Souls, which is the one everyone always jumps to. But I really love Drawing Blood because it's this weird haunted house novel. And it's just really strange. And it's part haunted house, part kind of dream world, part – like it's just so weird. But I remember I read that one a lot. I probably read that 4 or 5 times. I remember one day when I was sick in bed, I just read like 3 Poppy Bright books in a row because they're fairly thin. And they were like my comfort reading, which is weird because they're kind of violent and gross.
Yeah, they are.
In parts.
Lost Souls is the one that he still gets email about and
probably.
Also
it's like the quintessential, it was the debut novel, which must
quite,
really
quite abusive email about, you know, why haven't you done more?
Yeah, yeah, because it's a vampire book and so vampire books tend to attract followings. I love Lost Souls. I love them all, but Drawing Blood is kind of the one that I keep thinking about, and yeah, I really, really like Drawing Blood.
I have a vampire book in mind, but it's and the greatest vampire book ever written.
Okay,
but it's, I haven't got to it yet.
Kim Newman one?
Nope.
Okay,
no, you're not going to
guess.
So,
what's your number 9?
This one you would never have guessed in a million years, and okay. I'll be honest, I don't remember much about it, but it's more emblematic of an author, The Caves of Clydor.
That's not the Victor Keller book,
no.
Is it? No.
By Douglas Hill.
Okay.
Another famous UK young adult writer. This one was published in 1984. This was book 2 of a series about an evil empire and kids running away from the empire and trying to overthrow
it.
And it had laser guns and the stuff. And it was full of – but Douglas Hill wrote books like called The Galactic Warlord, and he wrote that sort of young adult-y science fiction and fantasy – that for a lot of people was the entryway drug into science fiction and fantasy for adults.
Okay.
So, again, another author who's in a sense been forgotten but had his height in the 70s and 80s when he was writing the sort of stuff that a kid like me would find in the school library. And see this cover with a kid with a laser gun shooting and a big – this one – the one I picked up, The Caves of Clydor, has the kid, you know, balding kid with a laser gun and a big snake creature with gook and gunk coming off it. And when you're 13, that's got to be the greatest thing.
That's your cover, isn't it?
That's got to be the greatest thing you've ever seen. And the book reflects that. So, you know, it wasn't one of those false covers you sometimes got with a huge spaceship and it's not set – and it's set in medieval England. So, you know, the point is that the covers were always – reflective of the content. So Douglas Hill, who is he? Look, you know, this whole thing has made me wonder why I haven't revisited some of these writers.
Because there's always more books.
Yeah, I know that.
I think that, like, it's interesting.
But I vicariously have the ability to do so now through children.
But you know what's interesting? Because, like, when I was making my list, like, I've already mentioned a book by Ramsey Campbell and Clive Barker.
Yeah.
I don't read them anymore.
No.
I've not read any new book by them in 10 years.
Yeah.
Now, I've not read... Poppy doesn't count because he hasn't published a book for ages. But I kind of I abandon authors. Like I kind of forget about
them.
Well,
no,
really...
because you read them when they're at their peak and at the strength of their tops. And they, people have downward – there are very few authors that can sustain a genius career throughout their entire writing
But
period.
I don't know that
– authors have their peaks and their
– But I – well, yeah. I mean, actually with – I think with Barker that was the case because the last couple of his that I read I just didn't like. So I just – didn't read anymore. I don't know why I stopped reading Ramsey Campbell. I don't know why. It's weird. Short story collections anyway, because I gave up on his novels a while ago. But
I mean, I read a shitload of Graham Masterton.
Oh, my God.
But once you've read three or four Graham Masterton novels,
talking
you've
about
read them all.
Good writers.
No, but it had lots of it had gore and boobies in it. Was
like good writers is like why do I abandon good writers I've liked? Why have I abandoned Ramsay Campbell? I don't know. I'm going to go look up. And
well, there's a writer I'm going to bring up that I've abandoned. Yeah. But anyway, yes, keep going.
Number nine.
Yep.
Ah, so number nine. I'm thanking you for number nine.
Of course.
Because you bought me this book.
Did I?
It's a beautiful little hardcover. And it's called The Pillow Friend by Lisa Tuttle. And you bought
it for
my birthday or something 1 year.
I did. I vaguely remember doing that.
There you go. And it's one of those books. I don't, you know, I'm going to reread it. And making this list has made me decide to reread a few of these. Because it's one of those books, though, that bits of it have stuck with me and I think about it a lot. And now that I've like actually sat down to make this list and I've really thought about it. It's like, huh, I wonder if that was a book that was kind of an influence on Perfections. Because the more, like, it was stuff about wish fulfillment and wishes not quite happening the way they should, and a sort of female protagonist and weird stuff happens. And it's like, I've never like made that connection before. It's like, I wonder if, so I want to reread it again. And I really hope I haven't copied The Pillow Friend. With my book. I haven't. But
Lisa Tuttle's lawyers will be in contact.
No, I haven't. But yeah, it's just like little scenes and images and just things that have happened or as I remember them, because as I said, it will be very interesting to read it and see what I have crafted in my head that this book is as opposed to what it is. But I love this book and it's weird and
I wonder
strange.
If I actually read it before I gave it to you. Not the copy. I gave you a new copy. I didn't give you a whether I had actually – because I do remember. Anyway, well, I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm
so
glad
thank you for that because it's a book that has stuck with me for like however long. It was published in 91 and I've got the hardcover version, so I assume you probably gave it to me not long after that.
Was that a Del Abyss book?
I can't remember. Okay, so it stuck with me for a long time.
My next book, are we up to 10?
We are up to 10.
Okay. How are we going for time?
We're fine. Keep going.
All right. I will. look, you're coming up with all these lovely, varied novels. Oh, this is basically a theme. They're the same. This is, you know, there's no variation here. Star Smashers of the Galaxy Rangers. Don't
God, you shouldn't have drunken water before you said. What is it called?
Star Smashers of the Galaxy Rangers. And there are people listening to this podcast who will immediately know who the public who wrote that.
Who wrote that?
The guy who wrote Soylent Green, which wasn't called, you know, but Harry Harrison.
Oh, okay.
1973, that one. I could have actually picked any Harry Harrison novel. He, again, was very much a gateway drug into SF for me. I could have picked all the Stainless Steel rap books. You've heard of Stainless Steel, right?
Yep, yep.
I actually started with his very first novel, which I didn't know at the time, which is the Death World series, the first Death World book, which is 1960. Harry Harrison. I mean, again, when you're a 15-year-old, like me, or 16-year-old, white Jewish boy, don't think the Jewish thing has anything to do with it, though, and you're reading science fiction of a period, Harry Harrison just seems to be always there, and you know, and it's funny, and like the Star Smashers of the Galaxy Rangers is, you know, very much about what the title says, which is, you know,
what it says on the label.
Yeah, you know, a guy gets caught up in this Galaxy Rangers, and they fight, and there's baddies. It's just great, and I don't know. And again, Harry Harrison, another author who no one really talks about these days. Even though he's got a huge,
I've never read one of his novels. I've probably read the odd short story in an SF anthology.
It's very likely the Stainless Steel Rat books themselves will have had Suck Fairy all over them because of the nature of the Stainless Steel Rat. He was a cad and he's a con man. I should have probably picked a Stainless Steel Rat book because I remember that better than I do Star Smashers. But
that's okay.
But Star Smashers has a great title, or the Technicolor Time Travel, Time Travel Machine or something. Anyway, but Harry Harrison.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. My number 10.
Laser guns. Yes.
My number 10 is another book you introduced me to, or an author you introduced me to.
Basically, I am your formative person.
You're one of them. Which is 20th Century Ghosts by Joe Hill. And
how did I introduce you into that?
You pointed him out.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
Pretty early on, too, because I've got the really nice hardcover first edition. So,
oh, okay.
But I know, I remember you saying, oh, you need to read this book. And I didn't think you knew he was Stephen King's son.
No, I didn't.
You just said, oh, the short stories are excellent. You should read them. So I did. And they are excellent. And I've liked his novels. Like, we did Nosferatu on the podcast, which I really loved. But again, like, thinking about this and also thinking, you know, to be honest.
It's got a new one coming out, actually.
Charles Tan. You did, because I didn't have the list made before Charles sent the email, and it did make me think, you know, damn it, if I'm choosing an emblematic book, I'm going the short story collection, because really, and there's stories in this, like there's pop art about the inflatable boy and the cape about the guys with the...
Which he turned into a comic series.
Which is a horrible story.
Yeah.
Again, it's one of those books where, and I actually picked it off my shelf when I thought of it and flicked through and was like, oh my God, yes, that story. Oh my God, that story. It's such a good book, and it made such I read that and was like, oh, I need to read everything this guy has written.
And he's got a new one coming out, and of course there's Lock and Key, which is his...
I actually have a very expensive sub press version of Lock. I'm scared to read because it's very expensive.
It's a graphic novel.
I know, but it's big.
Okay.
Like it's like one of the big...
Snap your wrists big.
Yeah, so I think I'm just going to have to get the trade papers and venture into Lock and Key. So 20th Century Ghosts.
Okay.
Emblematic of Joe Hill.
Okay, so my next one is... Look, I'm so vanilla. It's 1984. Come on. George Orwell.
Okay, cool.
Published in 1949.
I have to say.
Read it at school. Blew my mind.
One of my things to shorten my list or to make my task easier in devising my list was to say I'm not going to do the classics. The only classic I kind of had in there was We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which is now gone. So
yeah, okay. So I've come up with what is basically an extremely boring list. But frankly,
no, it's
these
good,
are
though,
books
they
that
complement each other.
These are books that...
Yeah,
blew me away.
I loved
And you hadn't heard of The Case of Clyde Orr, right?
I had not.
So, but 1984, I mean, what can you say? Look, 1984 is a book which has a great beginning, an astonishing ending, and a middle where he goes completely off the rail. No, I mean, I actually think if I'd read it now, not when I was in my youth, I'd enjoy the middle, where it's a polemic about totalitarianism
language
and all that. And it's the thing that it's sort of the MacGuffin that Winston is there to find.
I read it when I was young too, and I think I felt the same, that bit was like the tedious bit you kind of wanted to skip through.
Because suddenly the font gets smaller and it's just block parrot.
It's all just about, thought speak and the language and not,
But when you get past that, and I think I'd appreciate that more now.
I think you would. I've reread it since.
You, of course,
it's really
you, of course, get into, what is it, room 201 or whatever it is. And one of the great interrogation, it is a pure dialogue. And it's one of the great moments in literature. If you have not read 1984, and I'm talking to the audience, you must read it.
If you want to.
No, you must.
Okay. My number 11 is not really spec fic, but it was one I really wanted to put in here. It's The Chimney Sweeper's Boy by Barbara Vine. And Barbara Vine is the alter ego of Ruth Rendell.
Yes.
And I never read any Ruth Rendell, because despite the fact that I mainlined Nancy Drew when I was a kid and other girl sleuth mystery books, I never got into crime in a big way. It just hasn't really interested me as a genre. I've read a few here and there, but it hasn't really interested me. But Barbara Vine's books are also centered around crime, but they're not from the point of view of the detective or the people investigating it. It's a crime that has happened in the past, and her current characters who are often narrating the story, or they're at least the protagonist, have either uncovered this thing that they're trying to get to the bottom of, or it is something that's happened in their past that they're not really telling you until they have to. So they're really intimate, personal stories about very bad things that have happened.
Have you read more Barbara Vine?
Yeah, I've read a lot. The Chimney Sweeper's Boy, I can't remember if it was the first one I read, but it was one of the first ones I read. And I chose this one because it just pushes all my buttons. It's about a best-selling novelist who's died and is left behind a wife and a couple of kids, and there's these secrets and they're digging them. And it's amazing. It's so intricate and woven beautifully, and you don't see anything coming. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and I love it so much. And I've loved so many of hers. And this is how fickle and unforgiving I am as a reader. I read the last one she wrote, didn't like it, and I've not read a Barbara Vine since.
You are so evil.
I think it's because
there's too many books.
There's too many books.
And you just don't want to go back and go, well, why?
So it's like, that one wasn't very good. Oh, look, shiny. and there's a new one, like, stacked up from a new person. And you go, oh, this one's – I'll read the – But it has really, like, it's like, wow, I'm quite unforgiving now. It wasn't that way when I was younger. I would plow through not good, like Stephen King, for example. If I think I had the same attitude, I would have given up on him long ago. Rose Madder may have done it. Gerald's Game probably definitely would have done it. But yeah, no,
Gerald's game's fine.
Oh, I don't really like Gerald's game.
It's Rose Madder that's the problem.
Yeah,
and I'm actually surprised you.
Oh, and the one about the ass monsters. Don't look at me like that.
No, I know. I'm actually trying to remember.
Dreamcatcher.
Oh, yeah, Dreamcatcher.
Oh my god! Oh, yeah, that's
the
such a bad
shit weevils.
Exactly. The shit I totally weevils. Would have. So I did used to be able to go. No, I like this author. They've made a fumble. That's okay. I'll get the next
which
one.
Which is the more recent one with the wife is remembering her dead husband with them, and they've got this
made up
language.
The long pale side of the Lissy's story.
Oh fuck, that's awful.
I liked enough of Lissy's story.
Oh, no, it's awful.
To keep reading that.
If I was going to give up on a Stephen King book, it would have been that one. Anyway,
but this is what. But you know, I tell myself like if I'd given up on all these points, it's like then I wouldn't have gotten to read Duma Key, which is amazing and I love it. I think I need to go back to some of these authors I've kind of left by the side and
this
maybe
is completely coincidental.
Look at some new books.
You know what my next book is?
What?
It's a Stephen King book.
Oh, okay.
Which one do you think I chose?
The Shining?
No.
Salem's Lot?
No.
I don't know.
This is the first one I read.
First one you read?
It.
It.
I read
right.
That was the first one I read.
Okay.
Not sure that's the best Stephen King book to start with.
Not a great ending.
Given it's about a gazillion pages long.
Not a great ending on that book. But anyway.
What's wrong with the ending?
Oh, that's a whole other podcast.
Oh, with the kids?
Yes.
And the fact that they essentially have sex with a...
It's not a good ending. Okay. It's not a good ending, Mr. King.
I thought you were talking about the turtle.
Oh, well, that's like just the Stephen King TM ending that you kind of like...
Okay.
But yeah, no.
Look, no,
anyway,
but
sorry,
it was the first Stephen King book I read. I think spoilt me a little bit, but yeah, you're right. That ending didn't bother me when I was 15, 16 when I read it because, you know, it actually was a bit
sexy.
Yeah, a little bit.
And they're 12.
Yes, it's only on reflection that I realise what's going on there. And I'll be honest, his writing is so amazing that you just get sucked into that this is an expression of love to destroy evil. Yes, I know now. What you're saying, and yes, I've seen this criticism before a bit, but at the time it was an expression of love to destroy evil and the freakiest clown to ever exist in literature.
I read it when I was very young, actually, because I borrowed it from the library when I was about 12 or 13, and it was the hardcover that had the dust jacket of...
What's the name of the clown?
Pennywise.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a dust jacket that had the cover of The Great and Pennywise looking out of it.
Yes.
And I borrowed this book from my local
and the
library.
Balloon?
And the balloon, yes. the boat floating.
The boat. Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I borrowed this book to read. And I was only about 12. And I got it home and it sat in my bedroom for a day. And I went to bed that night and I read the first bit, which is the boy and the drain and getting his arm ripped off.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the cover and then I went and put the book in the hallway and closed my bedroom door on it. And it went back to the library and I didn't go back and read it for a few years because it scared the fuck out of me.
It scared the fuck out of me when I read it. And that opening is horrible. Yes, okay, the ending.
And I think by the time I went back and read it as part of reading Stephen King.
It's love beating evil.
Oh, dear, this is a bit
it's
weird.
It's love destroying evil.
Oh, look,
evil.
He had the best of intentions, but it is so creepy in a not good way.
Still important book in my life.
Okay, so that was your 12?
Yes.
My 12 is a book by Kathy Koja, who I adore. And I have adored since I first read a couple of her bits of short fiction, actually. But then the first novel of hers I read was The Cipher, which is her debut. But the book that I've chosen is Skid, which is, I think, her second novel. And, oh, my God, I love this book.
I don't like Skin at all.
I love this book.
Oh, you do.
So much, mainly because it presses all the buttons. It's got art, it's got subcultures and weird body modifications and a relationship between these two women, which is fractious and passionate.
But written
and
in a dense...
I fucking love...
Purple...
Love her
prose.
Writing. You can say nothing to me. So I've chosen Skin because it really did... It was the first book of hers that I'd read, the first thing of hers that I'd read that had... That grabbed me. Like, I like the cipher. I like the short fiction of hers that I'd read. That's why I started to read the novels. And I read Skin. I was like, I am in love with you. I will read everything you ever write. And I pretty much have.
So you haven't disbanded, you haven't got rid of that Kathy
No,
Koja.
I've not. I've not read the two follow-ups to Under the Poppy, but that's because my PhD got in the way. I have them though. They're there waiting. They're reward books. But yeah, no, because I love her writing. I love how her writing has changed. She's written a lot of really, really, really good young adult novels, not all speculative. But yeah, I just love her stuff. But I chose Skin as like emblematic of Kathy Koja because it was the book that like got my heart. The first one of hers that really like went, this is an author for you forever. And pretty much has been. I love Kathy Koja. So yeah, you're at number 13.
That groan wasn't about Kathy Koja. It was just,
yeah, no.
I sort of now, anyway, I've chosen it.
What's your 13? What's your unlucky 13?
Well, it's another classic.
Okay.
In fact, I've got a couple more to come. It's Aldous Huxley. Guess which one?
Brave New World.
Yes.
Okay.
Did you actually read Brave New World?
I've read Brave New World. I didn't love it.
It's got my surname in it.
Does it?
Mustafa Mond, isn't it? Isn't that right?
I don't know. I can't remember. I didn't love it. I read it close to when I read, maybe even adjacent to when I read 1984 for a second time as like in my 20s. And I loved 1984 so much better. I liked what Huxley was doing and it was like a fun book to like to think about the concepts and all of that sort of stuff. But
I think I actually like it more than 1984. But Mustafa Mond.
Right.
Is the resident world controller of Western Europe, only one of only 10 world controllers. And that, I mean, just
that's,
on that.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's also it's also about that anti-Semite Henry Ford, but actually the important thing is that it has my surname in it.
Okay.
And thus was an important book. I'm still in my secondary school period here. So I read that for school, Brave mm-hmm. New World. My school obviously was interested in giving us 1984 and Brave, because we read both in a couple of years
probably
apart.
Had to write essays about compare and contrast.
Yeah, we probably did actually. Now I think of it. I think it was a year 11
and
book.
And you still like the books?
Yeah, no. Well, because they're on their own, they're powerful novels.
Yes.
And this is a powerful novel.
Yes.
But yeah, move along.
Okay. My 13 is it's my first Australian authored book. How about that?
See, I've done one, Gillian Rubinstein.
Okay. Can I continue?
Yeah.
So it's Dead Sea Fruit by Karen Warren. And it's a fairly recent book. It's only 2010, but it is a best of. So it's collected. It's a really beautiful book. Ticonderoga brought it out. It has collected a whole lot of her fiction over the years. And it's got some of my favorite Karen Warren stories, like Fresh Young Widow and Cooling the Crows and just a whole bunch. And Karen writes such atmospheric and creepy and, again, just kind of off-kilter, but nice. Like, they're nice stories for a while and then she just pushes you down an alley and bad things happen.
Karen Warren is a magnificent writer.
And I love, again, I love, like, I love Slights. I thought that was a really good novel, but I love her short fiction and she has this economy of imagery and language that she uses and that, as I said, they're deceptively nice. And Karen's nice. So her stories start out nice and then, yeah, they're not so nice. And I also love that, like, a lot of her work, probably the bulk of her work, is set in Australia and very much in Australia and suburban Australia for the most part, which is really refreshing to see because often with Australian fiction you either get the big cities, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, or the bush. And a lot of Karen's work takes place in the suburbs. You know, it's not in the middle of cities and stuff. It's they're quiet.
Something that American fiction has done for generations.
Absolutely. I'm putting that in because I've just loved her work forever. And this is a best of collection. And so it kind of represents literally the best of her short fiction, I guess. But it is 2010 and she's written some really good stuff since then, including her 12th Planet collection. And it was a toss-up actually between Dead Sea Fruit and her 12th Planet collection, which I adore. So that's Karen Warren as represented by Dead Sea Fruit.
Okay. So my next one, who was actually mates with Aldous Huxley, I just found out, is The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley.
Never read it. I have heard of it, never read it.
So this is my first – we're now year 12 in secondary school, all right? So this is for English literature that I had to study this. And it shouldn't be in a book I liked, but I just loved it. And it's my first taste of literary fiction, I suppose.
Okay.
And it was published in 1953 and is literally a story about a boy who acts as a go-between between two lovers, except they're not lovers. They're just a, they're elder. They're it's a man and a woman. And the big reveal about the thing about the go-between that is controversial and big about it is that in amongst all his go-betweening, this boy stumbles in on the two of them having the naughties.
Okay.
But it's a blink it and miss it scene because it was written in 1953. So you sort of have to figure out that they're rubbing the genitals together.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know.
That, it's a bit vague.
Yeah, but the whole thing that this young boy sees it and it blows his mind. But I don't know, it was – I haven't checked any of that up. I remember that. That's how that book has affected and impacted me. So
very cool.
Yeah, literary fiction, L.P. Hartley.
So that's your 14?
Yep.
So my 14 is The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which was the first thing of his I'd ever read.
Which was this close to being on my list.
And it just blew me away. I didn't and I still don't know how he managed to get that much emotion and depth of character and everything that is that book into the way he writes, which is really truncated and really stripped back. And it's, I kept looking at going, how, like, where is he hiding this? How is he doing it? And it's such a good book. And yeah, I've since read more McCarthy, but The Road is still like the one for me.
Okay.
It's such a good book.
All right. Mine is, my one and only Dean Koontz book.
Uh-huh.
Got to throw Dean Koontz in there.
No.
Strangers by Dean Koontz, 1986. Basically, a bunch of people get together because they're all. It's one of those books where a bunch of disconnected people from different parts of the world, well, different parts of America actually, come together in a place, and there's weird phenomena happening to them that it connects them all. And it's the one Dean Koontz book that I think is palatable and quite intriguing.
Cool.
I read a shitload though of Dean Koontz.
I read a lot of Dean Koontz and
in this period.
Strangers
is probably the one that I like the most. Phantoms isn't bad either. But yeah, once you've read about 15 Dean Koontz novels, you never have to read any. Probably five is enough.
Yes.
So there you go. I've given up on Dean Koontz because I don't read him anymore.
Yes, I gave up on Dean Koontz too, and none of his books made it actually. Okay, my number 15 is another Australian author. And 26 Lies and One Truth by Penn Peake.
Oh, that's a great book.
Which I love. And it's a really odd book. It's not quite a novel. It's actually, you know what it is? It's a mosaic. In retrospect, I think that's what it is. And it's really good. It's semi-autobiographical, but you don't know which bits are and which bits aren't. And it's got illustrations in it. And it's great. It's a great book. And yeah, I just love it. It's a book I still think about, and it's told in a way that's, you know, it's a non-traditional sort of narrative and non-traditional in the way that it's told, which always gets my attention. And this one worked really well, and it's a book I still think about from time to time.
It is a great book.
And I really love
highly,
it.
Highly recommend it. And his new book, Leviathan's Blood, is out. I actually have a copy of it in my bedroom right now.
So, yes, that's mine. 26 Lies, One Truth by Ben Peake.
This is a one out of the blue. The Eight by Catherine Neville, which was published in 1988. It's essentially the Da Vinci Code before the Da Vinci Code was written, because it has two – and I literally have not read it since the 1980s. Okay. Catherine Neville's just got a new book out. But anyway, completely irrelevant. It's essentially set in our – it's set in modern times and also 250 years ago, and it's a twinned mystery where they're searching for – some MacGuffin. It's really not important. But the reason it was important to me was because, A, it was a book by a woman, because by that stage I had not read any books by women, and we're now in my uni period, and it was a big fat book that had that sort and it wasn't genre. It was that sort of – now we'd call Da Vinci Code type history, uncovering something that is mysterious and conspiracies and all that sort of stuff. And it was actually quite compelling.
Cool.
And Catherine Neville is still writing, but that's the only
Catherine Neville
I've read.
Cool. Okay. My number 16 is House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danielewski, which you had to know would be in there somewhere.
Yeah, which is why I didn't put it there.
It's a book I absolutely adore, and we did a whole podcast on it, so I don't need to say too much more about it. But yeah, unconventional narrative, haunted house, weird things, meta fiction. I just fucking love this book so much. Love it. I now have the really expensive coloured hardback, actually. So I can lend my trade to other people, which I have currently on loan to someone.
Good. And and all people should read it.
Yes.
Now I'm going to tell you the greatest vampire novel ever written.
Okay.
Which is The Light at the End by John Skipp and Craig Spector.
I've not read that one.
Oh, my God.
No, I've not.
Oh, my God. Jason will have.
Yeah, he probably has, yeah.
Look, but I'm not, I don't like vampire novels. You're not Jason.
No.
Oh, wow.
We do have different minds.
Look, it's extremely violent. It mm-hmm. has subways in it. It's in New York. It has vampires. They are fucking violent vampires. It's Skip and Spectre at their height. It's one of their more famous novels.
Yeah, I never really liked the Skip and Spectre stuff, I have
it's
to say.
Probably because it's a bit misogynistic, but no, I don't know. I'm just throwing that in there. I haven't really read a Skip and Spectre for a long time. Again, they split as writers and do their own thing now, but The Light at the End is,
okay.
Wow, yeah, that was...
The Light at the
well,
End.
Well, it's a splatterpunk book. This is now my splatterpunk period.
Okay, right.
As the next book I choose will... Okay. We'll show.
All right, so that was your 17. My 17 is another author I realise I've abandoned. It's Chuck Palahniuk. And
I've got a Chuck Palahniuk. Which one's yours?
Haunted.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Fine. I abandoned him after Pygmy, which I just hated so much. And I realised I've never bothered to go back and find any others. Until then, I'd read everything. It's like, oh, one book, you're off my list. I'm really, I don't know if I like that about myself. It's almost like I'm looking for excuses to stop reading something.
But Haunted again, short story.
Haunted's great. Haunted's it's described as a novel, but really it's a collection of short stories with a very loose framework, which
extremely
is in itself
loose.
A story, but doesn't, you know. But some of the short stories in this book, like the one about the anatomically correct dolls.
Yes. Did we not do a podcast on Haunted?
No, I don't think we did.
Okay.
Or maybe we did. I can't remember. Maybe we did.
Sure.
Long ago. Well, if we did, go back and listen to that and you can hear what we said about it. But no, so I chose that one because, yeah, honestly, like it's more than any of his novels, bits from that book have really stuck with me. So, yeah, Haunted by Chuck Palahniuk.
Okay. Mine next is Books of Blood, Clive Barker.
Right.
Come on, I can't believe you didn't do Books of Blood.
No, I thought about it, but actually it's Weaveworld that really – Weaveworld is the book that I think about when I think about Clive Barker.
Specifically Volume 1 because I really haven't read many of the other
right.
volumes. But look, Books of Blood, Volume 1, yeah. Clive Barker,
oh,
and his most
great.
Violent
short
stories.
Stories.
And, it's got the one in the subway where everyone, the meat
oh,
train.
Oh, the midnight meat train.
The midnight
yeah.
meat train. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's an amazing story. Anyway.
Yeah.
If we do seem a bit rushing these last few, it's because we don't want to go on for 4.5 hours.
Okay. My next one is, very recent one. We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves by Karen Jo Fowler, which I know we only did in the last couple of years, but oh my God, it was such an amazing book.
It's an astonishing novel.
And a lot of these later ones are ones that have, you know, I've loved them as a reader, but they're also books that have made me really think about writing and an aspect of writing and the way she crafted that narrative to hide this really important plot point that you didn't even realise was being hidden.
Yeah.
Was masterful, and it wasn't just a gimmick, it was really important for the story that was being told, and it's a fantastic book. So it had to be there. I love that book
It is brilliant.
Yep.
My next one is The Ideal Genuine Man by Don Robertson.
Oh, you made me read that years ago.
It's a great book.
I don't remember anything about it except that I just kind of went, that's okay.
It's a wonderful book. Don Robertson has been completely forgotten. He was mostly a writer of Civil War fiction. He, though, was a major inspiration for Stephen King, which is why I know of him to begin with, and also actually someone at uni just handed me this book. And this particular version edition, which was published in 87, has a foreword from Stephen King. And when you read it, you realise what sort of influence he had on Stephen King, because a lot of Stephen King's paragraph structures take a lot out of
I do remember Robinson. Noticing that, because that you gave me the book and said, oh, this guy was a Stephen King influence, and I do remember noticing it. But
if you get very hard to find his work now, you'll have to go to Advanced Book Exchange because a lot of it's out of print. But at the time, in the 60s and 70s, he was actually quite, with books like The Sum of Us and that, he was quite well known. The Ideal Genuine Man is a great book.
Cool.
In spite of what Kirsten might say.
Okay, my number 19 is The Limits of Enchantment by Graham Joyce.
Oh, that's a magnificent
novel. I love that book. I love how it treads the line between not knowing whether the magic is real or whether it's just the character who thinks the magic is real. And it's not one of those books which is so ambiguous that you get to the end and you go, well, I don't know if it's real or not, because it's so true to the character's beliefs and perceptions, you know, like, and it's just that you don't know whether she just believes it or whether it's real. And it's, and the way he wrote that to have that flowing through the whole book, And she's a great character, and it's just I love that book so much. I love a lot of what Graham Joyce wrote, but The Limits of Enchantment, I think,
again,
it's,
you're picking it's some my really, book. Some real corkers. That's a beautiful novel. Mm. That made me cry, that book.
Yeah,
wonderful. Mine is a short. Next one is a short story rather than a novel. It is The Night They Missed the Horror Show by Joe Lansdale. The greatest short story ever written. Tell me you've not
written. No, I have read it. I don't think it's the greatest short story ever written, but it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
It's got a snuff movie in it. It's got a dog being dragged behind a car and rotting away as it's being dragged.
Not necessarily my prerequisites for a great short story, but
it's
there you pure, go.
It's one of the great splatterpunk short stories.
It is. That I will absolutely agree with you on, yes.
Okay, next.
That's a little cheat. You chose a short story.
I know. I had to mention it.
You could have found the collection that it was in and...
I had to mention it.
Okay, number 20, another book we've done on the podcast, Sea Hearts by Margot Lanigan. Because, again, I love this book, and it's one that's stuck with me. And it's a book that, you know, when I was reading it, like, I could taste the ocean. It's just beautifully written, and, yeah, love it. Love it to death.
Okay. My next one is We Have Always Lived in the Castle.
Ah, excellent. Excellent, right. Yes.
So Shirley Jackson, I should have read this when I was younger. I didn't. But the podcast taught me the ways of Shirley Jackson and how fantastic she is. And you can go listen to our podcast episode for
again,
that particular
and,
one.
And one of my absolute favourite Shirley Jackson pieces, actually. And I love that book to death. I love the sisters and the way it's written. And again, that thing where you're not sure whether things are magic or not, and I don't think they are, but I think Mary-Kat is written so beautifully, and she absolutely believes in the magic. So you kind of believe as you're reading it.
Yeah.
Okay, so my number 21 is Gifts for the One Who Comes After by Helen Marshall. And we did her first collection, Fleshside Hairside, for the podcast. And this is the second one, and I love it even more. It's amazing. It's got such good stories in there. Funnily enough, it has a story called Secondhand Magic.
Oh, really?
Yes. But no, it's the prose is beautiful. The environments and atmospheres she creates. There's wonderful, evocative little stories and little worlds that she manages to get in there. And I love it. I love this book so much. Really liked her first one, but this one is amazing. So, Gifts for the One Who Comes After by Helen Marshall.
My next song, actually, that's not a mistake because it's got song in the title. My next book is On Wings of Song by Thomas M. Dish. Mm. I've chosen a Dish book. That's his most famous novel. I'm not going to go into the plot now, but that is his most famous novel. I'm actually republishing all my very old live journal Thomas Dish reviews on my blog at the moment, which were written in 2009, and I will get to that one in about 6 or 7 weeks, my review of that book. That is, I think, probably his best novel, but again, another author who's forgotten, and so part of why I'm republishing the reviews is that I'm trying to get people to remember, because, of course, my blog is so popular.
Absolutely.
Thousands of suddenly start to read Thomas Dish. So, On Wings of Song, magnificent cool. book.
Okay. My next one is, again, I really could have chosen almost any of his collections, but I've chosen Love Songs for the Shy and Cynical by Robert Sherman. Did you choose that one?
I chose Tiny Deaths.
Uh-huh. Almost chose Tiny Deaths, but then I went and looked through all of the table of contents, and Love Songs for the Shy and Cynical has Roadkill and Not About Love and Be of Good Cheer, and oh my God, they're just... I really love... I don't think I've read a single Rob Sherman story that I haven't loved. Like they are so good, and his style of writing, which is so nice, like he writes so nicely, and not that, and often nice things happen too. Like he's written some beautiful, optimistic, sweet, hopeful stories, but he's also written some really dark ones, and they're probably my favourite, as you know, you probably have heard from the titles I read out. But yeah, I love Robert Sherman's work. I'm very sad, but completely understanding that he seems to have abandoned the 1,000 stories.
No. He hasn't abandoned it. He did it.
He didn't finish it.
Yeah, he did.
He didn't publish them all on his blog.
He didn't publish them all on his blog, though.
Ah.
But they were all done. In fact, he did more.
But he didn't publish them all.
He didn't publish them all.
I hope they're going to get what published he has at done, some point.
What he has done, which I don't want to say too much about because it's not in existence, but it's incredible. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay, I look forward to that because I was very sad when that blog's dried up. And it's like, oh, no, I was really enjoying them.
They're all done.
Excellent,
they have all been
written. I mean, I knew they would have to end up somewhere else.
They have all been written plus extra and something special, we hope.
Fabulous.
Well, he hopes anyway, will come from that.
So excellent.
And mine, by the way, because I'll jump to mine because it's going to be the last one I was going to do, but I'll jump to it anyway, is Tiny Deaths.
Okay.
Because it was the first – I mean, I had known Rob for some time, but this was his first book.
Yep.
It's extraordinary, won the World Fantasy Award.
It's a really good collection.
This is the one that won World Fantasy, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, look, it's the point is – yeah, I love Rob, and I love this. I love his writing,
absolutely.
And I could have picked love songs as well.
Yeah, any collection really. Yeah. You know. Okay, so my number 23 is a one I read only last year. It's The Thing Around Your Neck by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and is a short story collection. And it's funny because often I realize when I'm sampling a new author, if they have a short story collection, that's what I'll read.
Yeah.
Even if they've got six or seven novels, as she does, I'll go for the short story collection.
Yep.
And so that's what I did. And this short story collection is amazing. And one of the things that really, really impressed me about it is that she's got two short stories in there written in the second person, and they both work, and they're both brilliant. And it's not often you come across...
I don't know. I like the second person. What is this people's bugbear with
because
stories that
really,
say you?
It's really difficult to pull off. It's a really, really difficult point of view to pull off.
I'll say that just N.K. Jemisin in the fifth season just pulled it off. But anyway, okay.
I'm not saying can't be done. I love it too. I'm quite fascinated by it. But it is really difficult to pull off.
Right.
And when a lot of people write in the second person, it just doesn't work. But Adichie's... her whole collection is fantastic. She's a Nigerian author.
Yep.
And, this is – I came across her because she did that TED talk about representation in fiction and seeing other representations of yourself in fiction and so on. And so then I went and looked up her work and I thought, oh, I'll try her short story collection. And, oh, my God, it is so good. It is so good. So I absolutely recommend what she writes. Her work is – it's evocative – she just has a wonderful way with words and a really concise way of depicting characters in just a very short sentence or two, and you know who they are. And fantastic. I'm looking forward to reading more of her work.
We're down to the last two.
We are.
Mine I'll be very quick with because we did a podcast on it.
Okay.
Guess which book? Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Look, it's an astonishing novel. It's 20th anniversary this year. Unfortunately, David Foster Wallace isn't around anymore.
Yep.
But it's 20 years old this year. And look, I know it's a long book. I know it's a tough book. But if you don't want to read the entire novel because you think it'll take 6 months of your life, which it could, at least watch the film The End of the Tour, which was last year, 2015, which is the interview that never actually got published at the time between David Lipsky, who's played by Jesse Eisenberg, and Foster Wallace, who's played by Jason Segel. Essentially, Lipsky comes to Foster Wallace at his home, and for a period of, he's there for a week or 2 weeks while Wallace is touring Infinite Jest, and we learn about Wallace and Lipsky, and a lot of it is based on the actual tape recordings that the real David Lipsky took at the time. It's a really, really informative, really, really good film.
Okay.
So if you don't want to read Infinite Jest, just watch that film instead, or the interview that Wallace did with Charlie Rose during the...
Oh, I did watch that one.
Yeah, yep. Which is also fascinating. But look, it's a great book, so read it.
Okay, so my penultimate one is another short story collection. It's At the Mouth of the River of Bees by Kid Johnson. And again, it's fairly recently published in 2012, but it collects a whole bunch of her stories.
Yep.
And it's got ones like Spar and Ponies and Story Kit that we read in.
Yep, I've read the other two too, so they're all great.
And the titular story, At the Mouth of the River of Bees, is a wonderful story. All her stories are wonderful. I love how she writes. I love how she experiments with the form. And reading her work teaches me so much about writing. But I also just love, it's really hard. It's really hard to separate the reader and writer side of me out. But,
Jonathan Strand's just edited a novella, which is out in a few months.
I've heard, yes. Really looking forward to that. I love Kid Johnson's short fiction. It's fantastic. So
it's a tour novella that'll be out soon.
Great.
Yes. Jonathan says it's very good. Which he would, because he's editing it.
So your last one.
Yes, is a Chuck Pagnanook. And again, remember, I was doing this in period, so this is really emblematic of a guy who I came across during my university years. But this particular book is one I've read more recently, which is Rant, the Oral Biography of Buster Casey. Uh-huh. It's a more recent one of his, recent as in 2007 recent.
Yep.
Look, I just like the structure of this book.
That was after I'd abandoned
it. Yes, exactly. It's a science fiction novel. It involves rabies, as most science fiction novels do these days. What is great about it is that it's structurally done so that each character, of which there's quite a few, has it's like chapters have viewpoints from each character, okay. But it's like their name and a block of their thought and then their name and a block of thought.
Okay.
And
I might need to go back and pick that one up.
I stole that idea for a short story I once wrote for a big Finnish Doctor Who collection because it's so smart. And, I think it's one of his strongest, more recent
books. I might need to pick that one up because, I think I need to go back to some of these authors I've prematurely abandoned, perhaps.
Prematurely, indeed.
Okay. So my last book is – I thought about it. I thought, damn it. It's really recent. I've just read it. Am I still going to love it in 5 years? I think, yes, it's Lewitt for the Afterlife by Lisa Haddad.
Yeah, why not?
Because I can't tell you how much I love that
just
book.
Just won an Aurealis Award. No, it didn't. We didn't get nominated for an Aurealis. We just won a Dittmar Award.
Let's not talk about that this episode.
Won a Dittmar.
It did just win a Dittmar, deservedly so. It's a brilliant book. It's a fantastic book to read from a writer's perspective. But it's also just a great book. I love it so much. It's in my – I think of this as kind of like a desert islandy thing. These are books I want to read again and again and would go back to. Have read again.
You're 25.
Yeah.
Yeah, and mine – look, these are the formative books of my life, at least the first 17 or 18.
And it's certainly not the – oh, my God. My original list was almost 50, just – as like you, just jotting things down, and then now I need to cull and what comes out. And oh no, but I love this book, but I don't have enough room for you. And
I will say this: I read a shitload of books, more books by women and people of color now than I did when I was young.
Yeah, yeah,
because just didn't read those books, and that's not they weren't available. I just subconscious bias or whatever. I didn't read them. So anyway, that's still my formative list.
But that's our
50th.
Our 50, and there was only one duplicate, which I subbed out, so
yes.
That's good.
I know, isn't that amazing?
We have 50 books.
We have 50 books.
Okay, so listeners, we've kept you long enough, I'm sure. So next episode we are actually going to be talking about the Aurealis Awards, which were just announced at the beginning of this month or the very end of last month. I can't remember the exact date. And we are going to be looking at two of the winners. They are A Single Stone by Meg McKinley, which won the Best Children's Book, and In the Skin of a Monster by Catherine Barker, which was the Best YA novel. I thought that'd be a good combination to look at.
I'm very much looking forward to this.
But we'll have a little bit of a chat about the awards beforehand anyway. And those two books, which should be great. Before we go, I did want to thank four new patrons this month. MH, Nick, Carolyn, and Julia. Thank you all so much. We love you. We really, really appreciate
keep that moolah coming in.
Stop it. if you want to send us some feedback, we really do appreciate it. You can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can also follow us and comment on Twitter, which is @writerandcritic, and there you mostly get Ian. And, of course, if you can, we'd love you to sponsor us
and
on
Patreon. Anyone can have a slice of cake in honour of our 50th episode. We didn't bake one, but
no. You
did have a nice piece of chocolate popcorn.
Nice piece of chocolate popcorn. It was lovely.
So congratulations to both of us.
Indeed. So here's to another 50.
Yeah, we'll be 100 by the time we get there. Yeah, 50 plus 50 would be 100, and we'd be 100 years. Anyway, doesn't matter.
Anyway.
Bye.
Everything.
Okay.
I keep everything. I know I shouldn't, but I do.